Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
They have the skate of their lives in the short last night. They smashed their season's best score by more.
This is Now or Never. I'm Ife Chiwetelu.
And I'm Trevor Dineen. And what you are hearing, it's nothing major. Just the sounds of a former guest making history.
World title on the line. You know you need to skate your best. And you need to be in the best mental state to do it. Opening with a huge triple twist.
We met figure skater Deanna Stellato-Dudek last season. Now, she had given up competitive figure skating at 16 after an injury and thought that that part of her life was over, until she came face to face with a question while playing a game one day at work.
My question was, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? And I just immediately blurted out, without even thinking, I would win an Olympic gold medal. And I asked my mom to get my 17-year-old boots and blades out of her basement of her house. But I still thought, let me ask someone who knows this better than me, which was my old coach. And she said to me, if you want to do this, you can do this. And I said, okay, well, then I'm going to really think about this and make the decision. And I made it pretty quick, and I haven't looked back.
This is when all the training comes into play, deep in the program, when it counts. Last throw. There it is.
At 40 years old, Deanna and her Paris partner, Maxime Deschamps, won gold medals at the World Figure Skating Championships in March, making Deanna the oldest woman ever to win a world title in figure skating.
Can I get like a quote beside the record book and see like 40 is a new 20? It's something I carry with pride. I'm very proud of it. I hope a lot of athletes stay around a lot longer. I hope it encourages people to not stop before they've reached their potential. And I hope it transcends into other areas, not just in sports, but also in other areas of life, like work and professional careers.
Trevor, I'm not saying we helped her win a gold medal, but...
It's kind of like we won a gold medal as well.
Not at all. She did all the work.
I know.
So happy for her.
Congratulations. You know, we often meet people on the cusp of chasing some kind of goal in their life. And I think it's so fun to do these shows where we check in and see how things are going.
Then you are going to love this next story too. Clary Ager and her wife, Percy. We first met Clary 2 years ago when she was planting seeds on her Victoria, BC balcony, dreaming of becoming a farmer. But they had no land.
I mean, we're farming in our condo. Behind me is like a whole industrial shelf because I'm starting seeds inside. Like, I have a farm for them to plant into, even though we don't. The only thing we ever grew in my backyard was my mom had this very small planter, and it would grow like 3 strawberries, like legit, like one for you, one for me, one for your sister. Like, I feel like I have grown. Past Clary was like, I feel really nervous to do this because I don't have any of the experience. You know, when you're filling out a thing, it's like, do you have this? Nope. Do you have this? Nope. Do you still want to continue? I'm like, yes, because I know that the only way forward is by trying.
Clary and Percy kept trying to find land for their dream farm. And it turns out that quest took them literally across the country.
Hi, Ife and Trevor. It's Clary Ager.
And Percy Ager.
And we're calling you from our flower farm in Cape Breton, Big Bredor. We're looking at an incredible view of Kelly's Mountain with the Bredor Lakes and what used to be our sunflower field last summer.
So we moved to Cape Breton 9 months after Clary was on the podcast before. We purchased a 12.4-acre farm in Big Bredor, and we are in the process of turning it into a flower farm and event space.
When I think about before planting seeds in our Victoria condo to now, I feel like anything could be possible because at that time it still felt impossible, but I had this idea inside of me anyways to just ignore that impossibility and to go for it anyways.
You just kind of have to, I think, like take that risk and follow your heart, really.
Yeah, exactly.
We love a happy ending.
We truly do. But the truth is, not every story turns out how we wished it would. Life doesn't stop when our episodes do, which is why today on Now or Never, we're tracking down some of our favorite guests who joined us in the middle of their Now or Never moments to find out what happened next and where they are now.
This is Now or Never. Where you been?
Hey, Efi and Trevor. Just wanted to reach out to perhaps provide you with the answer to the question I assume you've asked yourself many times. I wonder if anything happens after we do an episode. The short answer is yes, it does. My name is Michael Kulikowski, and I teach a grade 4 class in Thornbury, Ontario. I heard your story about Michelle from the Superhero Project, and we listened to the episode in class.
Listen, if a Now or Never story has rippled through your life, we always want to hear about it. And I remember the one that he is talking about very well. 2 years ago, I dropped in on 9-year-old Michelle Louise as she was about to open a special package.
Yeah, it's big. Look at that.
I know. It's like, you know, it's bigger than both of our heads. Oh, and it's heavy. Michelle has been waiting for this moment for months. Inside this package is a drawing that a stranger from halfway around the world drew for her. A sparkly, colorful, larger-than-life drawing that reimagines 9-year-old Michelle, who has cerebral palsy, as a superhero.
For one thing, I love superheroes. Mm-hmm. Like, me and my brother love to watch, like, Flash, Supergirl, like things that involve, like, people saving lives and stuff, like, yeah, like that. So, yeah. Really, I just like superheroes, and really to become one in a picture, it's exciting.
It's part of something called the Superhero Project, where kids with serious illnesses and special needs are interviewed about what powers they have and how they would make the world a better place. Then, an artist takes that description to create a superhero alter ego. And for Michelle, let's just say she could use a little superhero boost right now.
I actually got bullied when I was in first and second grade. So really much, this is actually kind of like a dream come true to be a superhero, yeah.
I heard the show, I heard Michelle, and I thought, holy smokes, what a great kid, what a great story. And the children in my class are the same age. Like, the focus of our class all year has been to look at things from a different perspective and come from a place of kindness. And I think that those sort of fundamental principles in our room really lined up with Michelle's story and the Superhero Project in general. I thought it was worthwhile for Michelle to hear that her story does matter, and this has impacted my class for our entire year, and I think that that's important. I think the other key thing is having a class of 24 kids where somebody says, hey, we should reach out, we should do something, and that we just do it. And I think that that's kind of important too, that the kids felt empowered that we could do something beyond our classroom. We've been working with acclaimed photographer Leah Denbach. The students created photos with Leah that were auctioned off last night, with all the proceeds going to the Superhero Project.
When we heard how big an impact this story had on Mr. Kulikowski's grade 4 class, we decided to organize a virtual visit between superhero Michelle Louise and the class, including Lily Summers, who wrote a letter to Michelle.
Hi. Hi. I first of all liked that she had dogs in her picture. And I thought it was great that she loves dogs. And also, I thought it wasn't too good that people were bullying her and that would make a change.
Go ahead.
How did you react when you were getting bullied?
Very, very sad. And to be honest, it was one of the most times of my life where I felt like I didn't mean anything to anyone. I would come home every night and just cry because of how sad I felt. So, but now I use that as a strength. And I really appreciated these kids writing and connecting with the Superhero Project, because the Superhero Project means a lot to me. I didn't really think that doing interviews would actually inspire kids. It actually warmed my heart so much knowing that kids were able to connect and be able to figure something out to donate money, and I really appreciate that.
Kids, $500 so far, right? Not bad. We appreciate, you know, your story and sharing it, and hopefully now we can take your story with our class and keep spreading the message that is so passionate to you. See you, Michelle.
If you want to see the images and the story that moved this grade 4 class into action, we will share it with you on our website, cbc.ca/now or never. Today, we are checking in on some stories from the past and finding out what happened after we switched off our microphones. And the reality is, not all of the stories we share turn out the way you hope for. And this is one of them. When we first met Josephine Harper and Fedja Redzepovich, they made a big impression on us. Two friends from opposite sides of the world, Josephine from a small reserve in northern Manitoba, and Fedja, a refugee from Bosnia, who had somehow found each other and made an instant connection, mostly by making fun of each other.
Well, yeah, look. This is what I texted him too. Because remember, he asked me for banana bread?
Like, I love banana bread. And for whatever reason, like, I struggle making delicious, adequate, well-made banana bread.
No, remember, I owed you banana bread, so this is how it's going to look.
Actually, what she sends me, you know, in, what does it say?
Simple banana bread. It's banana a bread. Bun.
Yes, hot dog bun and a banana bread inside. So, yeah, this is Josephine. Yeah.
In their 7 years of friendship, Josephine and Fedja had been through a lot of ups and downs together.
It's complicated. It's like support worker / friend, or sometimes, you know, so I just name him Monday to Friday now, because he only responds back Monday to Friday most of the time.
So, meanwhile, yeah. Like, I just see Josephine more than I see my family, you know, or my soccer team that I play for.
He never gave up on me, and you know what? That's what everybody needs, actually, is just that one person in order to make it this far like I did.
In her 34 years, Josephine had been through a lot. An unstable childhood that led to addictions, years spent living on the streets of Winnipeg and in and out of prison, which is where Fedja, a housing support worker, first crossed paths with her.
She's probably one of the most, if not the most, incarcerated lady in the recent history in Manitoba.
I connected with the wrong people, but at that time I didn't know. I was still just a kid. I didn't even know anything, actually. And then I realized that drinking gave me so much relief from away from my problems. I was so damaged from my past that, like, I learned from observing. And I learned how to fight from seeing people, how they fought, because nobody taught me any different. So yeah, that's the reason why I started going to jail.
She was continuously in and out on numerous breaches when I met her. She was literally left without any options. Long story short, they needed somebody who would physically sign for Josephine to be released from jail. I say, yeah.
He picked me up. I rolled my eyes. He was trying to be all smiley. And I don't know. I couldn't stop staring at him. I was like, what the f*** is this dude? Seriously, he's up to something. I didn't know what it was at the time, but it didn't make sense to me. Like, just some random person bails me out, you know? Like, he was just my jail out of free card. Yeah.
I liked her from a get-go. She was absolutely full of life. Loved her personality and aura. She was misfiring on all cylinders.
He picked me up because I was supposed to get picked up a day before. And I was losing my patience and I walked out yelling my head out.
And the jail guard goes to me, he's like, oh, just so you know, you gotta take her. She can't come back. So now me and her are stuck in a van that has automatic closed doors. And she tries slamming the door, but it's a comedy channel because the thing goes like super slow, which is making her even more frustrated. And this Josephine is calm, cool, collected. That one was like hell on wheels. You know, I was sometimes the only constant force where she could unleash whatever the frustration was, and I never took any of that to heart. And I'm a middle-aged man who came from a war-torn country, like, so, like, it's just another way of, you know, expression.
The more we joked around, I'm like, I don't think I realized I started opening up to him, or just a simple text here and there asking how I'm doing. So I kind of got used to that. It's like, oh my God, okay, this guy's not going anywhere. The stuff he was doing, like dropping off whatever I need, wherever I was, he went out of his way.
It was hard. It was, you know, many times I'd pick her up from jail and, you know, our relationship was very much up and down, and I don't think she was ready to change at that time. I don't think she was ready to trust at that time. I am not even sure whether she was ready for a friend. But I could tell that she was sick and tired of her reality that was been existent for a very long time at that point.
I started talking about my situation of addictions, how it started from trauma. Started talking about it, and the more I realized I talked about it, they made me start to realize that wasn't okay. So I just decided to do things different. And that's how I stopped. I wanted to live. So I had to change myself first to do that. I kept reaching out to Feja. I'm like, he was there for the whole way through. I've experienced abandonment all my life. He was the first person that didn't. So I became to love him for that. And it's unconditional love for sure. And he's the first person I've ever experienced that with. And it's a really amazing feeling, and to have that support and no judgment whatsoever. Like, but I think like everybody deserves to have Feja. Because there's not a lot of Fejas out there, but you know what? Everybody deserves a Feja.
We had that conversation with Josephine and Feja last February. And at the time, Josephine was about to celebrate 1 year of sobriety. She was living in her own apartment and going to school. And then we found out last week that Josephine's life had taken a turn over the winter. We met up with Feja to talk about his friend again.
Well, we never stopped being in each other's lives, ever. Doesn't matter what was going on, doesn't matter the obstacles, doesn't matter whether she was sober or not. That was kind of the whole point of, I guess, the connection and investment that we had. She just relapsed, and she relapsed for her own reasons, right? Like, she had to leave her entire life behind. Loneliness crept in, you know, lack of resources, lack of options, lack of support. Facing your, you know, demons and fears because they're not being masked by alcohol or whatever other substance. So she might at least struggle. She was extremely lonely and she was a lady without too many options. And what happened? What happened is the relapse. Reality is, you know, when she did relapse, she relapsed hard. She battled with liver cirrhosis, and it just got to the point that her body wasn't able to handle the reality of, you know, drinking and reality of substance use. And she got a phone call from a hospital basically saying that she's in ICU, and came there, and it was October 19th at 8:15 p.m. she passed away. And I was there in the room, and I was very happy to be there in the room. You know, we've gone through a lot of stuff together and a lot of good stuff together. No matter how much good, bad, or the ugly happened in her life, her spirit was not breakable. Her health was. The consequences in life, you know, the poverty, the homelessness, the violence, the you know, everything that goes along with, you know, unkind life. But her spirit, it's ironclad. There was no breaking Josephine's spirit. One thing I can tell you, she fought better, harder, braver than most people I have ever met in my life. And that shows a character. It shows self-belief. It shows many things that most of us don't have in our back pocket. Most people will go through life not having to fight that hard or believe that hard, seeing how hard she had to fight and how hard she had to believe. Nobody ever chose to be sleeping on a bus shack. Nobody chose to be addicted to anything. Sometimes traumas and lack of options and, you know, circumstances that do that to us. And I think that's the most important thing to remember. So when you're, you know, driving by Tim Hortons and you see somebody panhandling, could be you, it could be me, could be a brother, sister, mother, father, could be anybody. For anybody listening, the reality is, if you're honest with yourself and you think about how much you've gone through life, and if it wasn't for others, most likely you and I would not be here either. So I can't even imagine the things she would have done and accomplished or experienced if, you know, it ever properly worked out. She's one of the smartest, kindest, and by far the most resilient human being that I met. I don't think she ever stopped believing that, I guess, the life and outcome can be different. You know, even her last days, she was full of life and jokes, and she had plans, and just got cut short. She'd be laughing today, you know. You can't break the unbreakable, and that's, you know, truly was reality of who she was and how she viewed herself and the world. And yeah, my life's a lot quieter now, and I just miss her. You know, it's probably not a day that I don't, you know, think about her one way or another. She changed my life, and I changed hers, and she has provided many solutions for many problems that I didn't have answers to before I met her. And I refuse to believe that the end is the end. It's, you know, people are only gone when you stop talking about them. And she made such a great impact in my life that I don't think that is ever going to happen.
Josephine is still such a part of Fetch's life and his work. He has a photo of the two of them that hangs on the rearview mirror of his truck. And he's working on a new project at Wabanga Benoujiak Healing and Crisis Center in Winnipeg to build 26 housing units for people who have been impacted by violence. And he told us that Josephine's voice, her insights, her experiences, their memories are all what's driving that project. It's set to open in early 2025. This is Now or Never. I'm Ipi Chiwetelu.
And I'm Trevor Dineen. And this week, we're reconnecting with former guests to find out what is happening in their lives now. And sometimes the best way to do that is just by picking up the phone.
Hello?
Mr. Hugh Britton.
Yes, Trevor.
How are you doing, sir?
Oh, not too bad, thank you.
Good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, it's nice to be in contact again. Was you right on time?
I know a teacher likes punctuality, so I was like, I need to be on time. I'll be honest and say I also couldn't wait to make this phone call because Hugh Britton's story felt like it was straight out of an old detective novel. And you, our listeners, you jumped on board to try and help solve it as well. But I think I'm getting a bit ahead of myself here, so it's best to start back where it all began.
For the last 43 years, I've been trying to return diaries that my students had written when they were in elementary school.
Hugh was a teacher back in the 70s, 80s, and up until he retired in 1995 at Havelock Elementary School in St. John, New Brunswick. Now, Mr. Britton was passionate about inspiring his students to write. So for years, he'd ask them to write diary entries, and he promised never, ever to read them.
Each morning, they would write whatever they liked. What they felt about certain things, what was bothering them, what they were looking forward to, and they were able to be themselves because they were going to be the only ones that would read them. And I said I would, upon graduation, see that they got these and they could look back to see what their thoughts were when they were 12 years old. So I lived in the neighborhood where I taught. So I knew where a lot of these children lived. So I hand-delivered them. And, of course, some had moved away. So in the end, I was left with 26 diaries.
One of those diaries belonged to Austin Hutton, who couldn't believe how this little lost book that arrived in his mailbox could transport him back to his youth.
It takes me back, I guess, to a time that was completely different. And it's a warm feeling, right? The warm fuzzies. I've always been fascinated with history. I like history a lot. And for me to touch a piece of my own history that I'd kind of forgotten about and would never have known about, it was lost. So for me, there was that chill, and I did. And even now talking about it, I still get goosebumps because it's a little piece of me that was lost and forgotten, I guess.
When we last talked to Hugh, he only had one diary left. He was looking for Kimberly Annette Longley, but couldn't find her anywhere.
I just didn't have the heart to dispose of them. And I knew the kids put a lot of effort into these, and they deserved to get them if I could find them. I wish I had been able to have a diary when, you know, I was in school. Time goes so fast, you don't realize how the years go by. And when you look back, you think, well, where does the time go? And I'm getting up in age, and I felt that, you know, I'd like to see that these go to the right places while I have my senses and, you know, I have my health. If I can bring a bright spot into somebody's day, it's worth the effort.
Our audience not only agreed with Hugh, but they decided to help in his efforts, as hundreds of listeners respond to the shares and messages and posts to try and help him track down Kim. It was a puzzle, and everyone wanted to help find that final piece. So today, let's find out if he did. This has been a journey.
It has. It has. You know, it was such an exciting experience. So here we are, the last one. To track down was so far away. No wonder it was the last one.
I know. Isn't it crazy that this diary went across the world?
Yes. It's exciting.
Were you surprised that so many people like were just gung-ho to help out with the case of the long-lost diaries?
I sure was. And to think how, you know, through the CBC, you certainly have an awful lot of listeners and, you know, people who are really anxious to help out and to see how that worked, you know, that last diary, you know, that her aunt would pick that up on the radio while visiting her son in British Columbia and then relaying the information back to you and then getting in contact with her mother in Nova Scotia and then sending the parcel to England. And she got it and she gave me a rundown of what was in it. And it was kind of comical.
You sent me a picture of you holding the diary and you had the biggest smile on your face. Like, what was going through your mind when you were going and just dropping that last one in the mailbox?
I was really so happy because, you know, I kept that in the top drawer of my dresser, and every time I opened the drawer, this letter would pop out. And I thought, oh gosh, it's never going to be delivered. This case is not going to be solved. And then, by the roundabout way it was solved, it gave me great satisfaction and enjoyment.
Well, Kim is going through some personal things right now, but she wrote to me and said, the first thing to admit is that I'd forgotten all about writing a diary, but strangely, I'd never forgotten Mr. Britton. Hugh, as I finally gotten accustomed to calling him, had little chance of finding me without the power of radio, as I had moved to the UK not long after leaving university, gotten married, and have lived abroad ever since. I was astonished to receive contact from several family members last autumn, encouraging me to listen to your program. While I had literally no memory of writing a diary, I knew that it must contain references to horses and probably some drawings of them. As it happened, it included some shaky illustrations and details of an afternoon spent pretending to be a horse while jumping over lawn chairs. The diary reached me in time for Christmas, and I shared it with my family at home in Canada, which was a gift in itself. We laughed at my code names for fellow students and my delusion that I could never compete with any of them at track and field events. As fun as it was to walk down memory lane, I value my new email exchanges with Hugh just as much, and we are regular pen pals now. I will definitely leave him an electronic trail of breadcrumbs if I ever decide to go down the road again.
Wow. That's a lovely letter.
Well, you made a lot of people happy, Hugh. A lot of people. If you were to write, let's say right now, if you were to write in a diary today, how would you sum up what this whole experience was like for you?
Well, I would say, dear diary, I have completed the task that it's been decades long. I would like to say thank you to all those students who received diaries and who enjoyed them and who got back to me and made comments and are friends with me now on Facebook. Thanks to the CBC and all those folks out there that were listening to it. They've solved the problem of getting the diaries back to all these original writers, and I appreciate and thank all those people who helped out, and I hope you have pleasant memories and just enjoy the rest of your days.
If you want to see a proud Hugh Britton holding that final diary just about to put it in the mailbox, head on over to our CBC Now or Never Facebook and Instagram pages.
Over the years, we have met a lot of people who have taken a leap into a new career. It can be a big risk dropping what you know and trying something completely new.
But sometimes you've got to just suit up and go for it.
I've been everything from an ogre to a dog journalist to a shark to many different colors of bear. Bear mascots seem to be really popular. I've also been to Mascot University, which is held at the Mascot Hall of Fame in the Chicago area. And I've also traveled to Japan to a mascot festival to study Japanese mascots and see what I can learn from them.
That is Richard Raycraft. Now today, he's a professional mascot for hire. But back when we first met him, he was working as a journalist here at CBC, a job that he was completely happy in, even if it wasn't the career his father, Gary, had necessarily envisioned for him.
It was 2008. It was the height of the Great Recession. Unfortunately, I had to look for my first job around that time. It was not easy. You had picked me up from a kickboxing class. Do you remember what you told me you thought I should be?
Well, I think I told you a variety of things, but certainly one of them was that I thought you'd do an excellent job as a sports mascot.
You don't hear that very often, a parent pushing their child to go into the mascotting field. In fact, his dad's suggestion that Richard should put on a costume and dance for entertainment is something he could never quite figure out.
My teenage brain at the time thought it was actually a plot to sort of humiliate me. Like, if I could do this demeaning job, get in a bunny suit and dance in front of other people, then I could do anything in the future. That's what I thought at the time. Now, this mystery is sort of plaguing me.
So, where do you go when you're trying to solve a mascot mystery? Your friendly neighborhood mascot shop, of course.
Okay, this is the back.
Oh, that's the back. Okay. I'm here, and I may as well stop resisting. There's a brand new hog outfit hanging nearby.
So now...
And I'm going to put these on like a sort of suspenders?
Exactly.
Okay. And finally, the head. Once this bad boy goes on, there's no going back.
Okay, I'm really taking the plunge now.
No turning back.
For a moment, Richard Raycraft will be dead. There's only the hog.
Oh, okay.
Check that out, right? Okay. So I'm just going to tuck my neck
there. I expected I'd feel even more self-conscious with a giant pig costume on, but it's not like that at all.
And then with the other foot, you're going to put the heel down and lift the toe up.
Like this.
Exactly, and then do a wave with one hand. That's like one of the most common mascot poses out there. I'll take a photo like this.
I'm realizing that when you're fully enveloped in a mascot costume, it's like armor. If people laugh, they're probably having a good time and laughing with me. And if they're laughing at me, well, it's not really at me, it's at the hog. And I start dancing in front of these strangers. No hesitation, no inhibitions. Richard Raycraft has those, but this pig doesn't. He's not afraid to shake his little piggy tail.
I can't dance even outside a mascot costume, so.
But then, because this is for radio, I have to break a big rule of mascots. I have to talk while dressed as a giant hog.
This has been transformative. I don't know what it would be like, but it's different than I thought it would be like. So this is fantastic. I really wish my dad could see me. Yeah, he would really like this.
Now, dressing up as a giant pig one time in the back of a costume shop, it's a start. But how do you know what life as a mascot is really like unless you take the plunge?
I got an interview with a minor league basketball team, something my dad would be proud of. Yep, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
In your own words, what do you think Duncan's mascot, Duncan's personality or persona is, and how would you portray that?
I think Duncan is really about fun, right? He brings the fun to the games. Watching sports can be stressful. It can be fun, but it can also be stressful. And I think Duncan is really sort of the... Hanging up on the job interview, I feel nervous. I realize I really want this. Although, it's a bit strange to audition for a mascot with only a phone interview. I mean, don't they want to see my dance moves? To do this job right, I decide I have to get some practice in. I'm going to rent a big bear suit from Hogtown and invite a bunch of friends and neighbors to watch me perform on my parents' driveway. I invite my dad, who, in typical Gary Raycraft fashion, neglected to tell me about his trip to Mexico. But that's okay. Because if there's one thing I've learned, it's that this is something I want to do for myself. It's not about him anymore. It's about what I want. And what I want to do right now is dress up as a bear and dance. I bust a move with people watching in a bear costume. Flossing, the running man, a terrible moonwalk, some random dance I heard is popular on TikTok. I do it all. I even pick up an old staff I used to use in karate class and start twirling it. And finally, to cap it all off, I slide down into full splits.
Hey.
I did it. And I think I did okay. But I need to know what the fans think.
It was certainly funny. I didn't know what I was going to expect, but it was entertaining. You had mentioned that you had not practiced in the suit. That was clear that you hadn't gotten used to what it was like in a giant bear costume.
Very creative and very awesome. Good job.
Oh, I think it was amazing. It was just the guy's like a flexible Bigfoot that I've never seen such a rendition before. The only thing that's missing is a little bit more of the moonwalk.
Very, very impressive and joyful, and I wanted to move right with you, you know. Yes. And the splits at the end, wow, you know, very impressive.
Yeah, my moonwalk sucked, but my splits are great. It's true. And it was fun. And I think the most important thing was I wanted to do more of it. But next time, I don't want to rent a costume and perform in my parents' driveway. I want to do it for real. And that brings me back to what started this whole strange adventure. When I was 16, I feared having to work as a mascot. I actually fought with my dad over it. And I thought about how he might just never let up. He'd never be satisfied until I did this goofy, humiliating job. That's what I thought then. But now I think about my pending job application, and I'm anxious about not getting this job. Like if they told me, "Hey Richard, you're just not mascot material," as a teen I would have said, "Thank God." But now, even if I get that message, I'm going to keep looking for mascot jobs. So next time you're at a game or an event in the community and you see a mascot, who knows? It just might be me. Hey, Ify and Trevor. So since we last spoke, I've actually been in 16, by my count, 16 different mascot costumes. I've quit my job as a journalist to become a full-time mascot. Right now, I have 4 different mascot jobs that I'm doing. Everything from a sports team to a business to a nonprofit. And I think I've truly found my calling inside a silly mascot costume.
Ify, as someone who once was a mascot, the Folklorama Llama, no big deal, I hold a kinship with Richard. And I want everyone to see him in his mascot outfit. And we have photos if you head on over to our CBC Now or Never Facebook and Instagram pages.
Check it out. This next update has us traveling the furthest back of all the stories this episode.
Ooh.
All the way to season 1.
Oh my gosh, that seems like a lifetime ago.
But listen, we were different people.
Completely. The show was just getting started.
Yeah, and that is when we first met Sean Thorne, a man who played a meaningful role in the lives of the children around him. He was a co-parent to his cousin's daughter, Uncle Sean to all his friends' kids. He was a behavioral therapist working with kids. But more than anything, Sean wanted to be a dad.
Every time I'm with kids, I want to be their dad. I want to be called dad. I want to be, you know, I don't want to be a part-time. That's what I feel like. I feel like a part-time dad to a lot of these kids. And I want to be a full-time dad. I don't know if you know how old I am, but I'm 48. So, yeah, I kind of feel like the clock is ticking. I want to be around for my kid as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want this friendship and this love to be around longer than I've actually been wanting it.
Sean tried everything he could. After 2 failed adoption attempts and 6 unsuccessful embryo transfers, trying to become a father had ended a relationship he was in, cost him his life savings, and taken his hope. He wrote a letter to his friends and family saying he was done trying.
My eyes tear
when I'm not even thinking about my loss. I feel like exploding, escaping, and just curling up in the fetus position and just remaining. It's unbearable at times, and it's like that feeling you get in your stomach when your heart is broken. It's like all the butterflies just died.
Sean's loved ones responded to that letter by starting a fundraiser to help him try one more time.
It's just been such a long journey and so many sad moments, and you know, I had lost hope, and there's still some damaged hope. In a year from now, I would love to see myself walking down the street with a baby in my chest, like on my chest. Like, I mean, people talk about strollers. I'm like, I don't want a stroller. I want the baby on my chest. That's where I see myself in a year from now, finally being the happiest.
Do you imagine a partner with you?
Would I like? Yes. Do I imagine a partner with me? No. I'm quite happy and content with just the vision of me and my kid.
And who knows, maybe a couple years from now, there'll be a new GoFundMe campaign. Get this guy a relationship.
Get this guy a guy.
Exactly. It has been 7 years since Sean was dreaming those dreams, and I'm excited to see how life has turned out since. And right off the bat, things are looking a lot different.
Bye. I'm going to get some legal. Bye.
Wait, you want to answer one of Ippy's questions first?
Bye.
You know what? I like a kid who has firm boundaries.
Yep, he does. Yep. I don't know where he gets it from. My name is Sean, and this is our son, Elio. And Elio is, how old are you?
How old are you, though?
And yes.
I'm Vincenzo, and I'm Sean's husband. Sean's happy husband.
I'm Audrey, and I am Uncle Sean and Vincenzo's honorary daughter, I guess you can say. Technically, like, niece, but more like a daughter. Yeah.
What words would you use to describe your family?
I definitely think fun is the main word that comes to mind.
Yeah, I think we have lots of fun together. We go to the bird sanctuary, like do a little canoeing together. A lot of great, fun outdoor adventures.
For me, it feels complete.
When we last connected, things were very different. You were wishing on one last embryo transfer with your surrogate. How did we get here?
Well, that last embryo didn't work for me, and it was so difficult for me. Vincenzo came into the picture with that last embryo. With Vincenzo happily jumping on board and being a part of my journey that became our journey, made it much easier to move forward, to make the dream come true. You know, the seventh embryo didn't work. And that's when we said, okay, well, let's keep going and let's find another surrogate. Let's find an egg donor. Let's find the money, the time. And we did. We found an egg donor, made another batch of embryos, and a surrogate was able to finish making our dream come true.
Yeah. How's the reality matching up to the dream?
It just feels really special, and it feels really an honor to be able to have a family like this.
You know, we're a rare couple amongst our friends and schools. There's not a lot of gay couples. And so we're still constantly feeling like we made something happen that's not possible, I guess.
I think that makes sense because you're saying it in the context of not seeing a lot of families like yours, not meeting a lot of gay couples with kids. And when you don't see yourself, it can feel like you're doing something impossible. What are you all dreaming of from here? I feel like whatever you speak on this show happens for you. So lay it on me. What can I follow up with you in 7 years and find out is going on in your lives? Elio's going to draw a boat, I think, or own a boat, according to the picture that he's holding up to me right now.
For me, traveling, focusing on Elio and Audrey, making sure that they're taken care of.
Yeah, and another dream that we hope to accomplish is to take a sabbatical in Italy, expose Elio to a different culture and learn a different language, have all of us learn a different language and to experience a different culture.
Yeah, lots more life ahead for you. If there's one thing that I have come to expect from you, Sean, is the unexpected. So I know whatever is in store for you, that, I mean, you face so much uncertainty and unknown that I'm sure whatever is up for you all in the future, you are well equipped to handle it.
Yes, I agree. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Bye.
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 While family is one of the biggest changes in Sean's life over the years, it is not the only one. He has also shifted careers and is now a published author of what else? Children's and young adult books.
You know, over the years, we've chatted with so many parents about the highs and the lows of having and raising kids. But surprisingly, we've never actually done an episode on motherhood. How is that possible? I have absolutely no idea, but we are about to change that next week, just in time for Mother's Day. And I thought that it might be fun to include a bit of a mom confessional on the show. Can just get whatever they need off their chest and share, like, the real, unvarnished truth of what it's like to be a mom. Because I can only speak as a dad myself. But there are times, if I'm being honest, when I will spend longer in the bathroom just to have some good old-fashioned silence away from my children. Or I'll eat the kids' Easter candy and play dumb when they ask me why some of it's missing. Or, you know, the struggle, the real-life struggle of finding new ways to say that the art that they're bringing home is good when in reality it all looks the same. It's just scribbles and random paint colors. I feel lighter just getting these off my chest. So if you want to have a little bit of fun and share the quirks of being a mom, call 1-844-375-5669. Again, that's 1-844-375-5669 and leave us a message letting it all out. Or email nowornever@cbc.ca. And I promise you, your kids won't hear it. Hopefully. I love these episodes that we do because so often we only get these little moments with our guests. And man, sometimes it feels like you're just checking in with an old friend. And I think you said it best the other day when you said it feels like sometimes we're just going back through the Now or Never yearbook.
I did say that.
You did.
I'm quite insightful.
It really touched my soul.
Well, it was fun to turn those pages. Thanks, as always, to the Now or Never team of producers, Bridget Forbes, Sarah Tate, Andrew Friesen, and Michaela Van Kooten.
And a special thank you to past Now or Never producers, Kai Hasselreis and Claire Bonnieman.
I am Ifi Chiwetelu.
And I'm Trevor Dineen.
We will see you next time.
Take care.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.